Hey, this is David Rovics back with you here on wherever you are watching. If you perhaps are on the Facebook page of KBOO Community Radio or Popular Resistance or my YouTube channel or somewhere else, later archived, if you look up the podcast This Week with David Rovics, you can find the archived version, which you may or may not be listening to right now anyway. But anyway, this is David, and I'm doing another interview program, which I used to do quite a lot, which I haven't done as much lately because I've been busy playing music and touring and all that sort of thing. But I'm very glad to have with me on the program Michael Albert, who I have been reading regularly in Z Magazine and elsewhere for the past 40 years or so, since I was a teenager in the 1980s. And Michael has a book coming up at the end of October on Zero Press called No Bosses, which I have been reading and reading about for the past couple of weeks in preparation for talking to him, and also just because it's a fascinating book and a fascinating subject. And Michael, great to have you.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, thanks for joining. And this book is fantastic, and it's also, it's a subject I've been reading from you for a long time, and about how the economics of a society and the whole structure of a society could be done so much differently than it is under capitalism or under many other ways of doing things, organizing society that have been written about and talked about. First of all, the subject is so huge, but that's also, I guess, the first thing I wanted to mention or talk about on this whole question of how everything can be organized in a sensible way is, I guess ever since you've been writing about this stuff, and I've been reading about it ever since, I guess, the 80s, I guess you've been thinking and writing about this stuff since I was approximately 0 years old, actually. But reading Noam Chomsky's introduction, and he was talking about meeting you in 1966, which was the year before I was born. But, it's basically been, it always just seems to me when I'm talking to people, to cut into the chase here, I spend a lot of time in Europe, and it always seems to me like, okay, well, everything could be so much better in the United States if we could just have some kind of European style social democracy. It would be such a massive improvement on what we have now. The kind of things you're writing about, of course, is going way beyond that. And I guess this isn't so much a question as the question is, how did you figure that this is really the thing to be focusing on for the past 50 years or so, how society could be structured differently, how economics could be done differently, and trying to tackle this issue that, as Yanis Varoufakis also says in his introduction to your book, is one that Marx avoided trying to address in his day, and so many others have avoided.
Yeah, well, for me, and the person who I worked with at the beginning of the process, which was Robin Hanel, it all started really in the 60s, not solely because the 60s were so much of an uplifting and an exciting time and that kind of discussion, but rather because of things that we encountered when we were organizing, which was people saying, look, we get it. You keep telling us what you don't like, and you know what? We understand what you don't like. It's not that complicated. But what do you want? And they didn't mean, what do you want in the form of a modest correction and improvement upon what we have? Not that there's anything wrong with attaining such modest gains, but they meant more broadly, what do you want that makes what you're talking about so different, that makes it worth our believing that if we attain it, we'll keep it, as compared to it devolving into something else horrible, or even more horrible, or just bouncing back to where we are? Why should I give my time? Why should we give our time to trying to win something that's unstable and it'll just bounce back, or something that'll be even worse? And at the time, we took the question as obnoxious. We took the question, I mean, literally, we took the question as people trying to derail us from asking for an end to the war, derail us from asking for civil rights, and so on and so forth, all the various kinds of focuses that existed at the time, on the grounds that we didn't have an alternative for everything. And that we took to be unreasonable. It wasn't the case that we had to have an alternative for everything in order to realize that poverty hurts and inequality is horrible and the war is destroying societies, et cetera, et cetera. We were right, technically. It was true. I think we were wrong strategically. Because while I think maybe some of our parents saying that to us, what do you want, were trying to just bludgeon us back into the home, you know, back into the normal order of events, a lot of people were asking sincerely. I mean, they sincerely wanted to know. And they sincerely wanted us to overcome, or they wanted to know why for us their cynicism wasn't operative. Why were we so willing to act? Why were we confident, et cetera, et cetera? And that set us off on the course of trying to do vision. As the more that we thought about it, the more that we thought that, well, okay, what this is needed for eventually is knowing where we're going so we can actually arrive there, clear enough. What it's needed for in the shorter term is overcoming cynicism, providing hope, providing an overarching perspective that can sustain activism when it goes through difficult times. And also that can orient it so that it's really trying for, it's trying to win gains that help people in the present, but it's trying to do it in a way that leads toward the future instead of just dead ending or, you know, devolving. And I haven't really changed those feelings very much. I still hold them. In fact, I think they're even more relevant, actually far more relevant, because not only are the crises so absurd, but the openness to thinking about and then advocating for a new kind of economic and social system is very real. It's very widespread. As much as, you know, left writing tends to focus on the catastrophes and the problems and the pain and the suffering, the reality is that there's a tremendous amount of turmoil and activism and a tremendous amount of openness to real alternatives. So I think it, you know, it's timely. It makes sense.
How much, I wonder, the openness to alternatives, have you seen this generally becoming more of a reality since the collapse of the Soviet Union? And I also wonder what during the Soviet period, which I'm a very large part of your life as a, you know, trying to talk about these things, was during the existence of the Soviet Union. I wonder how much of that, like how many people were saying, well, there's an alternative and look over there, that must be the one you're talking about.
Well, maybe some people would say that, but of course it wasn't the case. And it had the exact opposite effect, at least in the United States. The Soviet Union called itself socialist, and the United States called the Soviet Union socialist. And they had diametrically opposite reasons. The Soviet Union wanted to gain the credibility that the word socialism lent to what they were doing. The United States wanted to discredit the possibility of socialism or the idea of socialism by pointing to the same thing, what the Soviet Union was doing. And, you know, I suppose there was an element of logic for both sides. But, you know, for me, it was never a vision of what we should want. We can talk about that if you want to, but it wasn't. But the decline of the Soviet model, the fall of what was called Soviet socialism or 20th century socialism, whatever you want to call it, no, it didn't lead to a surge in openness to vision. I don't think so. I think for some people, it cemented the idea that you shouldn't mess with vision, that you shouldn't mess with trying for a new system, because a new system, in with the, you know, out with the old boss, in with the new boss. Who? Yeah, I mean, that was a large sentiment. In fact, there were people from Eastern Europe who I would interact with who felt that incredibly strongly, right?
Yeah.
They felt you know, they would read participatory economics and they would say, look, it sounds pretty good, but it's just going to devolve into Stalinism. That's mm-hmm. we know that's what happens. And it took me a while to get past that with a lot of people, because I do think it's wrong. And so, no, I don't think that was spurred it. I'm not entirely sure. When I was a kid, we turned left, I think, because, and now I'm talking about people like me, which was white, young people, students, etc., different for different constituencies. We turned left, I think, because we woke up one day and we discovered that everything we knew was a lie. And we were furious. And we just, we went more or less ballistic. And then the politicization followed quickly. That can't happen again because nobody believes any of it anymore. Right? It's just completely different now. It isn't the case that if you encounter, or at least not in my experience, if you encounter, you know, a 20-year-old student, or you encounter a 40 or 50-year-old working person, and you plumb the depths of their feelings, that they actually believe that doctors do nothing but help people, that hospitals are there not to make profits but to help people, that the government is to serve the population and protect freedom and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, but in 1965, we believed that shit. And so when the mask came off, because of the civil rights movement and because of the Vietnam War, we were just furious. And then thus emerged one set of movements. But the interesting thing is that nowadays, I think, when people are moving left, they're moving left not so much because they are angry at a lie. And if you think about it, okay, the solution to that is to fulfill the lying, you know, it's to remove the bad guys, remove the liars, remove the, et cetera. Now people, to the extent that they become sort of left open or open to the left, it's more, they're critical of everything. Something gave them hope. And sort of let them open their hearts and their minds to the possibility of change, rather than holding themselves in a sort of a cynical, I don't want to look at this stuff. You know, I don't want to, don't bother me with this stuff because it hurts too much and I know there's no place to go. And so along comes Bernie Sanders, and in a sense, you know, a gigantic surge. Far more important a story than Trump was the dynamics around Sanders. And I think that's continuing. My own impression is that young people in particular at the moment, I mean, I just look at the world and I look at their situation and I think to myself, what has to be in their heads? I can't prove this. But I think they have to be on a knife edge between depression, despondency, despair, angst, and fury. But yeah, not fury at a lie, fury at a system, and, you know, fury at injustice and so on and so forth. I actually think there's going to be a gigantic upsurge before very long, but I can't prove that.
And it's always this contradiction between so many people understanding in a lot of way, very deep ways, what's wrong and how things could be different in a sane society. And then the big, huge question of implementation, of getting there. And of course, having the vision is so important. And then the implementation of it just is where I'll just, like, your imagery in the book about being lost in the desert and trying to get to some fresh water and having no option but to find fresh water somewhere or die. It's not a situation anybody wants to be in, but it's the situation we're in. So we have to find some way to implement these solutions. But I guess the partly the optimism that we all could potentially be feeling around this whole question is that so many people already do understand how messed up the situation is and how things could be done differently. And they have daily examples of how that works. Like, just as you, one of the things you mentioned is just an intersection at a traffic in a city and how people negotiate it, and or just family life or any number of other examples that don't require hierarchy and bosses to make it all work.
Yeah, but I'm not sure. I agree with you for sure that people at some level understand. You know, they can't recite chapter and verse. They can't, you know, lay out 37 examples that prove a point or something like that. It's not their place. But people understand that everything is broken. I mean, literally, you can't. I used to have an exchanges with Noam Chomsky about this. And about the sort of the importance of revealing injustice as compared to making a case for a full alternative and strategy. And I wasn't getting anywhere for a while. And then I thought up something that I thought maybe would have a case, which was back at the time when we had this discussion. I pointed out that half the country thought that Bush knocked down the Twin Towers. And I said, what are you going to tell people? What are we going to write in our alternative media, say in our speeches, put in our banners about how bad things are? That's worse than that. I mean, how are we going to shock anybody? How are we going to reveal anything? Everybody knows. Everybody knows. I mean, you know, look right now. People think that the vaccine is a plot against them. I mean, you can't be more cynical about power, authority, et cetera, than people are. Right. But I'm not so sure that I agree with you about people having a feeling for how much better things can be. Yes, people understand that you can have a higher minimum wage. People understand that you can have better medical care, et cetera, et cetera. But they also have a feeling that when you get those things, you'll lose them the next year. So the feeling is, if I want to do something for my family, for the people I care about, even for people throughout my neighborhood, throughout society, I winning these things is so transitory. So maybe for my family, I can do something that will help them for the long term. You know what I mean? So I agree with you. There's two issues. One is there an alternative? And two is, can you fight City Hall, corporations, and the power? Can you fight the power? And both cases have to be made. And that's where people's energy should be going, I think, making both cases. And the thing that makes me do, I mean, I do plenty of the other two, but the thing that makes me focus more on vision a lot is because I think you need the vision in order to do the strategy well. I think you need the vision to get a feeling for what kind of organization melts into what you want. You know, in other words, lays the seeds of the future in the way you want. What kind of interactivity in your movement? What kind of relations? What kind of issues? What kind of demands are on the road to where you want to go? Instead of being positive, taking you a little ways, but then it just all stops. And eventually sort of falls back where it was. So I think vision is very important for that too. Economic vision, I should say. Vision for gender and kinship and culture and political system. A notion of what really is better. So that when we fight, for an example, when we fight for, say, let's say a $15 minimum wage or $20 or $20, you know, as we should be. If we fight for a $15 minimum wage, do we do it in a way that says $15 an hour is good? $15 an hour is what we seek. $15 an hour and celebrate and go home. Or do we fight in a way that says, look, people should be earning income, should have a share of the social product, commensurate how long they work, how hard they work, and the onerousness of the conditions under which they work. So in fact, the people who are earning a minimum wage should be earning a maximal wage. And the people who are in comfy circumstances and doing interesting things, they should be earning less. And now that's not a demand you can make right off. But while you're organizing for $15 an hour minimum wage, you can be raising the issues that lead toward organizing for a $30 minimum wage. And that lead to demands about the nature of work and so on and so forth. And that's building a movement that keeps going instead of a movement that keeps stopping.
That kind of strategic long-term thinking.
Yeah. Yeah. But it does have implications in the short term.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Your example of scaffolding, is when you talk about the scaffolding, that you're creating a sort of a scaffolding for a building that's being built, and that's and then even though in the process of creating the scaffolding, I thought it was so interesting that both of the people who wrote introductions to the book had disagreements with you, and they expressed them in their introductions, which that just tells us that the whole process of trying to create the scaffolding is inevitably going to be a one full of all sorts of disagreements. Sure. Right. but it's important.
But it also told you something else, that Noam and Viennes are wrong.
Mm-hmm.
In that extent, and I think they are to that extent. So, for instance, I think one of Noam's concerns, which was raised much earlier, say for the book Pericon, was totally legitimate and has been taken into account in this book. And I'm not sure why he didn't see that and doesn't acknowledge that. So, for example, the criticism, which is perfectly legitimate, is, look, we're human beings. You know, nobody has a friggin' crystal ball. And the future is too complicated to do up a blueprint. And so that would be one of his concerns. And I thought that concern was perfectly valid. And I even added another dimension to it, because I thought there was a second dimension of that same kind of concern that was valid, which is, who the hell are we to tell future people how they're going to live? It's not our place. It isn't only impossible. It's not our place. And so then, since I knew or I felt that vision was so important, then what's the remaining logic and justification? And my answer to myself was, look, what's warranted, I mean, what is it that's warranted when we say, and Noam would say, you got to get rid of private ownership of the means of production? Well, what warrants that? Why isn't that a blueprint? And why isn't that telling future people how they're going to live? And my answer to myself was, well, that's a precondition for future people to be in control of their own lives. That's what distinguishes it. It's not saying how long they should work. It's not saying what kind of clothes they should wear. It's not, you know, we're not detailing future people's lives when we say you can't have private ownership of means of production, because if you do, future people are not going to, in fact, be making their own decisions.
Yeah.
And that's basically the condition that I put on thinking about vision. What it is doing is it's looking for what are the necessary preconditions, what are the necessary features that a future has to have, not the details, but the necessary features that it has to have people in control of their own lives, to have equity, to have, you know, solidarity and diversity, to have these values fulfilled. And so participatory economics isn't, you know, it's just a few things. It's like five features of a future economy, and that's all. It's not all those details. So that would be, you know, I guess my answer to Noam is I think the concerns are totally legitimate, but he's missing that his own concerns justify what's in participatory economics, because it doesn't go beyond what he doesn't want to go beyond, and it permits the situation that he wants to attain, people having control. Yanis, I think, that's an interesting case. We've become friends, and we're actually planning to do an extended interaction, I suppose you could call it. He's right. Written a novel. I think it's called Other Now. So you can think of it as having it within this novel, Other Economy. And it's his notion of, you know, an economy to strive for. And then we have participatory economics, and we're going to do an extended kind of contrasting and debating and exploring the two. I think for Yanis, the issue is he doesn't see getting beyond markets. He hates them. So he doesn't disagree with me there, right? Markets suck. However, Yanis doesn't feel we can get beyond them. And my feeling is we have no choice. If we don't come up with an allocation system that doesn't have the failings of markets and has the desirable attributes we need, then we're doomed. So we have to. And I think participatory economics fills, you know, participatory planning, which is the alternative allocation system, fills the bill. If it doesn't,
can you? I know that people should all just read the book, but can you talk about that more? Because I think this whole question of, I mean, at least to me, having, I'm not an economist, but I've been following, you know, macroeconomics for a long time, and I also just have a hard time imagining any large scale system that doesn't involve some kind of, like, at least, you know, market mechanisms, and I think it's a fascinating discussion. Seems to be the crux of his
concern. Yeah, I think his concern is, I hope you're right, Michael. I'm afraid you're not.
Oh yeah, yeah. Right?
That's basically the essence. I mean, what his sentiment is, and we'll see if we can get past that one in this next round of interactions. The essence of participatory economics is, let me just short an argument and then I'll do it. If we're going to fulfill certain, if we're going to have people self-managing, if we're going to have people participating in the decisions that affect their lives, then, in a workplace, that means we're going to have a venue where they do that. It's called a workers' council. And we're going to have to understand what a kind of a self-managed decision-making process is. And so we talk about that. And it isn't always one person, one vote, and it isn't consensus. It's basically apportioning influence in proportion to the degree you're affected. Okay, but let's say we have these councils. So we now have workplaces that are run by workers' councils. We've gotten rid of the owner. So there's no longer the owner. It's not just that the owner isn't accruing profits. It's that the owner isn't deciding everything, or the owner's lackeys aren't deciding everything. Rather, the workforce is deciding. Okay, that's good. Now, if we look at that and we say, what's the likelihood that the workers are going to, in fact, participate intelligently and confidently in decision-making? That's not so obvious, is it? I mean, if we look at the world that we live in, it's not going to happen overnight. It would require a change, not just in prior training, schooling as a kid and so on, but in the circumstances that you endure every day at work. It would have to be the case, the argument goes, obviously I'm doing it very quickly, it would have to be the case that worker circumstances empower them, that worker circumstances give them confidence and give them information and give them connections to others and social skills so that they could partake of the decisions. Okay, so that's another big condition. And that yields workers' councils plus what we call balanced job complexes, basically a new way of dividing up tasks so that everybody has comparably empowering work. Okay, what about income? Well, for us, it turns out to make sense to us that people should get income for how long they work. That's pretty uncontroversial. Although it doesn't happen in the real world. For how hard they work, also pretty uncontroversial. And for the onerousness of the conditions under which they work. You should get more income if you're working under worse conditions. You need it as an incentive because it's, right? But not for output. Certainly not for profit, for property. Not for power. Right, that's like a thug's economy. That's what we live in. Right, that is, we live in an economy with markets where bargaining power determines income. Property gives you more bargaining power. Being white in a racist context gives you more bargaining power, etc. So, not for power, not for property, and also not for output. It shouldn't be the case that you get more because you happen to produce more of value because you're genetically endowed in such a way that you can. Right. Or because you have better equipment or because, you know, that shouldn't be it. It should be duration intensity. All right. So now you have all this. And if you tie all those workplaces and together with the consumption neighborhoods, individuals and consumers, with an authoritarian central planning system, everything that you've got, and admittedly it's only a glimpse here, but everything that you've got is destroyed. The characteristics of the central planning are such as to introduce this powerful hierarchy between planners and planners' allies. It's coordinator class, people who are empowered in their circumstances, between them and everybody else, working people. And everything goes to hell in a handcart. But the same thing happens if you have markets. If you have markets, the competitive dynamic and the necessity to accumulate, and the necessity to maximize surplus, not profits, because they're gone, but surplus so you can compete. All these things diminish what you've attained. They eliminate that equitable remuneration. They eliminate the self-management and so on. And the old division of labor, it reappears also. That's a fascinating discussion. Anyway, so this all leads us to Led Rebin and I too. This is more or less the, you know, filled out the trajectory of thinking, and it ain't rocket science, right? That leads to, well, okay, it would be nice if we could just take the off-the-shelf allocation system, be it central planning or be it markets, but we can't because they annihilate everything else. So then what happens is you start to think about, okay, you've got these workers' councils and you also have consumer councils, individual consumers, and then neighborhood councils and so on. And you want, what do you want? You want production and desires, consumption desires, to match up. You want, right? And you want them to be undertaken in light of the social value that they convey, right? And so you need a system that somehow communicates to workers and consumers that, right? What it means to responsibly utilize the technology and the labor and the venues to produce stuff that's socially valuable, and what it means to consume in a way that is, again, consistent with your own well-being. And what we came up with for that was called participatory planning. And it's a, you know, it's not that, it's a mechanism by which, at the most abstract level, consumer councils and worker councils essentially sort of cooperatively negotiate inputs and outputs, using indicators, a kind of prices and budgets. And then you get into details and it gets a little more difficult, but not unduly so. And the net result, our claim is, and this would require, I think, looking at it, thinking about it, our claim is that this form of allocation is consistent with the other features. It's consistent with self-management and equity and solidarity, and it conveys to the consumers and producers not only fulfilling and dignified work, and not only fulfilling and worthy and appropriate income, but also the inclination and the capacity to participate and to, you know, be full members of society. If this is true, then participatory economics is a very valuable scaffold, because it's only a few pieces of it, scaffold upon which to build a fuel vision that we fight for. If it's false, and maybe it is, no, I don't think so, but maybe it is. If it's false, well then, you know, it'll at least give indication of problems. Because we still have the exact same problem. What isn't false is that we're not going to have a just, caring, self-managing, and even sustainable economy and society until we come up with an alternative. I mean, it's gotten to the point. It used to be, you know, people would talk about the apocalypse. You know, a lot of organizers would try and organize, you know, come to our demonstration or the world's going to end, right? And that's supposed to motivate you to come to the demonstration. And it was never true.
Never a good motivation, or the apocalypse hasn't happened
it,
yet.
That's it wasn't a good motivation, but it was also a lie. Regrettably, now it's not a lie anymore, right? I mean, it's a sad reality that we're on a suicide track. And it's still not really a great motivator. Somebody else who's much better at understanding human psychology would have to say why, because it seems like it ought to be. But I think what can be a motivator is not so much the dark end of reality, but the bright possibility, coupled with an understanding that, uh-oh, if I don't get this bright possibility, I'm in the sewer. We'll see. I ran on a bit. I'm sorry about that.
No, that's perfect. Wonderful. Good extended answer. After doing interviews long enough, I finally have learned to stop interrupting people I'm interviewing so much, you know, because actually sometimes they have a actual well thought out answer that requires a few minutes. but with the, you know, I think there's a lot of people who know some history, maybe they've heard about the Soviets, the workers' councils, and everything going wrong with central planning in the Soviet Union. And maybe they've also heard that maybe they're also familiar with the problems with capitalism, especially the excesses of capitalism and the tendency towards unsafe workplaces and environmental destruction and homelessness. And you know, so for the people that realize that capitalism left to its own devices is not a solution at all, but who think that markets have a useful role to play, for people like Bernie Sanders who are looking towards Denmark and as a example, and people often accuse me of doing that too, which I would emphatically say I'm not doing that. It's just that I spend a lot of time there, and so I make these comparisons because it's what I know,
right.
and it is
right.
very different from here, and right. and it is a massive step in a progressive direction from this country.
And that's true.
Yeah, and it's fairly evident to anybody yeah. going over there. Like, okay, yeah. where are the people living in tents? I don't see them. It's not because they're in prison. It's because they're in houses.
right.
But what about people who are saying, like, well, why do we need participatory economics of this sort of what might seem like an extreme form when we could just have a heavily regulated market that provides the kind of scaffolding necessary to prevent things right. like homelessness?
All right. There's more than one component to an answer to that, regrettably. But so one component
That's okay.
is there's a difference between it, inside an economy, there are going to be winners and losers in the market system. And the winners are going to display more of the characteristics and features that emerge from the market dynamic. That's true in the world also. So the fact that there are countries that maintained social democracy for a time doesn't mean that it is sustainable forever. You know, look at Sweden. And so what happens is it's an unstable situation in which you have an underlying structure that produces the likes of money bags, and where money bags pursues profit and money bags pursues power. And then you have these restraints, as you say, you have laws and so on. And there's a constant tension. And when moneybags gets the upper hand, those hard-won gains are dissipated. So the real trick is win the gains, but keep winning. Keep going so that you remove the, not just moneybags himself, right, but the producer of that. And that is in part markets. It's private ownership and markets and corporate division of labor and so on. And they produce those outcomes. And so the partial victories, and I really only think they are partial victories, but very real victories that you see with a higher, you know, a higher a minimum income and with protections against unemployment and with real health care and on, those benefits, which are very real, and shouldn't be sneezed at by any means, are unstable. And they are also, as real as they are, still a far cry from everybody having dignified circumstances and control over their lives. It's still a long ways from that. And so I guess what I would say is the reason is built into that. And then what is it about markets that's the problem? Markets are a zero-sum game. Markets are a competition between a buyer and a seller. Buy cheap and sell dear, or whatever the hell it is, where you're trying to fleece the other, right? So you're producing a society of atomistic individuals who see the other as a target for exploitation, even when you're not a capitalist, right? So you have the crazy dynamics, for instance, that we have now in the United States around, say, a pandemic, where it's incredible stuff. And so that's one problem, the problem of the impact of markets on consciousness and preferences. They also militate against collective consumption toward private consumption, which is tied into that competitive dynamic between buyers and sellers. So that's one thing. Another mm-hmm. thing is that there's this drive to accumulate, if when there's private property, it's called profits. In the absence of private property, it's called a surplus. What do you do with the surplus? Well, you try and keep market share. How do you do that? You advertise, you promote. You don't tell the truth. Who cares about the truth? You just do what you have to do to try and get more market share. How do you get that surplus? Well, lots of ways. You reduce income to those who are weaker, because that's the way markets work, bargaining power. And you also dump your shit in somebody else's backyard. In other words, and in fact, if making more shit, right, increases output and you can dump it elsewhere, terrific. Make more shit along with more bicycles or whatever it is that you're making. That's fine, because markets don't take it into account, and markets don't price it. They don't incorporate into economic calculation. So you get a dynamic that is, ameliorated, moderated by social democratic gains, but you don't get a dynamic which is eliminated, and it comes back to bite you when it undoes your gains. You get those gains, but you don't get the maximum desirable, right? And so I think the ultimate argument, however, is different. The ultimate argument for having in mind, say, participatory economics, or whatever is going to be the economic vision that people share, the ultimate argument for having that in mind is that it gives hope, it gives sustenance to the activist, and it orients our activities so that we still win those social democratic gains, but win them on the path to more rather than to stop and then go backwards. And that to me is the logic. I think actually Yanis is agreeing with that. That's where sure. the agreement's going to come with Yanis, and then it will come everywhere else too, I think. But and Noam already does. So,
I mean, you make a great, and I mean, just in the past couple of minutes, you make a great eloquent case for all the problems with markets, and many of the major problems with markets, and how they tend towards bad outcomes and need to be heavily regulated in order to have any useful aspects. But then the useful aspects, to the extent that markets have useful aspects to them, people arguing in favor of markets would be saying that the possible negative aspects to not having them would be overwhelmed by the positive. So I mean,
it's possible, right? So those are arguments that you have to make. That's what's in the book No Bosses, right? Arguments. Of course, you could say, look, well, Michael, you got this thing called participatory planning, and it's got some virtues because it leaves behind certain ills, but it's got these new ills, right? Exactly. It's got these new problems that outweigh, right? But that's what the book's about, determining whether or not there even are new ills, much less remotely on the level of what's being undone. Just as for an example, markets are supposed to be efficient, right? That's the virtue. The virtue is the real claimed virtue of markets is that they're efficient and that they incentivize properly to yield the best use of assets. All right. So let's ask first whether they're efficient. 40% of the food in the United States isn't eaten. The discussion is over, right? Now you can do this for, you know, countless things. Are they efficient? They produce such and such, and also this immense volume of pollution, which has the offsetting effects. Of course, the offsetting effects of the pollution are largely on the weak, and the benefits of the production are for the strong. And so one gets tallied and the other doesn't. Markets look good. It's markets misprice everything. They don't misprice a little bit. They misprice everything. Why? Because market prices reflect power, bargaining power. They don't really reflect the worth of the components, of the inputs, of the labor, for example, which is priced as low as you can get it. It's not valued properly. They don't take into account the ecological nightmares and so on. So markets, they get the job done, you can say, especially if you're callous about the fact that they're driving us towards suicide, then you can say they get the job done. And that you can say that's their virtue, but that's a very low bar, right? That means that an alternative has to get the job done, meaning it has to produce things and get them into people's hands, right? But can it do that consistent with greater equity, consistent with greater solidarity instead of a rat race? Can it do that? You know, the answer is yes, I think. And so that's what we have to demonstrate. That is, make an argument about and provide evidence for, not just claim.
Yeah. And there's lots of evidence as you document, of course, on all kinds of different local and bigger levels around the world, historically and currently, for how this kind of thing how things can be organized without central planning and without markets and really effectively. Can you talk about some of those examples?
Well, you know, we all have one in our families, or hopefully we have one in our families. That is to say, in our families, some of them are perverse, but most of them don't say, okay, you decide everything because you're God, and so you decide that everything will go to yourself except whatever sustains everybody else. Okay, central planning. We don't have centrally planned families. We certainly don't have market families in which everybody in the family basically competes with everybody else for everything they can get. I mean, it's insane. We wouldn't even consider it as a possibility, right? It wouldn't cross our minds. Imagine 1,000 people are shipwrecked on an island, right? And or 10,000 people shipwrecked on an island, but they're really isolated, and you know, like the TV shows, they're not going to get off anytime soon. So they got to do something. So they hold a big meeting, and Joe gets up and says, "You know, I owned, you know, such and such pharmaceutical company or such and such auto manufacturer, whatever. You know, I'm a capitalist, and that worked. So let's replicate it here. I'll, along with the 10 others like me and the 1,000 people, we'll own the island and all the resources. And what we'll do is we'll, you know, advertise for jobs, and the rest of you can work for us at the wages that we set as best we can." And with it's, and they Revolution. Go on and describe it. And the 1,000 people, hopefully they don't literally light a fire and let you know, burn the guy up, but they sure as hell don't listen to him, right? It doesn't even, or somebody gets up and says, you know, I was a college professor, or I was a doctor, or I was a lawyer. And, you know, I got some skills, fellas. I can put together an argument, and so I'm going to run the show. Now that one will have a little more weight, but with a little thought, it's going right down the tubes also, right? These are the kinds of simple-minded, thought experiments that reveal a lot. Mm. Now you still have to show that you can do it. You still have to show that if you don't let Moneybags be in charge of the island, and you don't let, quotes, scholar be in charge of the island, coordinator class person, that you'll get along and that you'll do well and that everything will be okay. I like to tell this story of, I tell it often, of being in Argentina after the economic, total collapse, but partial collapse led to literally hundreds of workplaces being taken over by workers.
Yeah.
And in a great many of them, what happened was the owner basically was punting because it wasn't profitable and decided, all right, I gotta get out. So they punt. The engineers and financial officers, what I call the coordinator class between labor and capital, between capital and labor, they decided we got to go too, because without the owner and without those assets and the things failing anyway, we got to get out of here. There's greener pastures elsewhere. The workers had no place to go. So the workers take over, and the workers institute workers' councils and democracy. Not exactly self-management, but ballpark. And they equalize wages too. Not exactly remuneration for duration, intensity, and onerousness. Although some places did just that. But at least equity, right? And one person, one vote. And so I'm at a meeting of about 50 representatives from 50 of these factories, and I'm supposed to give a talk. And before I start, I say, let's go around the room a little and hear where people are from and what's up. And it's a very dynamic, people are very elated in some sense. I mean, they're meeting others like themselves from elsewhere in Argentina, and they're getting along and so on. We start. And after a few people, the mood turns from, highly upbeat, really excited, to pretty depressed. And by about, I think it was the seventh person, it's disastrous. And what's happening is that each person is recounting in their own way what the seventh person then put pretty eloquently. The seventh person said, I never thought I would believe this. I never thought I would say anything like this. I can't imagine myself saying anything like this. But maybe Margaret Thatcher was right. Maybe there is no alternative. We took over the workplace. We instituted democracy in our workers' council. We made the wages equitable. And now all the old crap is coming back. And so that was when I interrupted and started to speak. And I asked them, I said, well, in your workplaces, when you do your changes, did you change the division of labor? Did you change the way jobs were organized and allocated? Or did you just keep it the way it was? And they didn't really know what I was talking about. They said, of course we kept it the way it was. That's the only way it could be. That's reality, And so I said, no, that's the root of the problem. And then we talked about how the way that the thing was designed, right, caused the emergence of a coordinator class, so that even though they all started working class backgrounds, working class experience, working class, mentality and culture and everything else, somebody becomes the financial officer, somebody becomes the manager on a particular line, and so on and so forth, and their views start to change, and their attitudes start to change, and they have to, because to do the job they have to, and so after a while you get the alienation coming back, the inner hostilities coming back. Then you get the people who are in the empowered positions wanting to raise their own incomes. And the people who are in the disempowered circumstances no longer coming to the meetings. Why not? Because it's so fucking alienating to sit there and listen to the other people decide your future, right? And to be so you don't even bother coming anymore. It's a little like big elections. So you don't even bother coming anymore. And pretty soon you're pretty soon you have what they had in the Soviet Union. And
right.
And but it isn't because of human nature. It's because
they weren't following a
it's because they kept the old strategy. Division of labor.
Right.
It's because they, you know, they just with all the goodwill in the world kept the old division of labor. And it then imposes this is what it means to understand institutions. That institution, regardless of people's desires, has intrinsic implications for people. And so that institution, which they kept certainly just to function, right? Not for any other reason, corrupted the rest of their changes. And that's what I was trying to describe about markets. Had they had the balanced job complexes, had they changed the division of labor, but then operated inside of a market, the pressures would be enormous to very quickly or before long begin to assess, well, wait a minute, why do we have air conditioning for all the workers? Maybe we can have that just for the one, you know, why do we have daycare? We can't compete with these things. We need to get rid of them. And then we discover we're not very good at oppressing ourselves, right? So what do? We go out and hire people to oppress us. We go to the business school and we hire people who are trained to be callous and to make decisions which compete. And when those people come in, this is sort of one of the only subtle things, I think. When those people come in, we realize that we can't have them be in positions like ours. If they're getting equitable income and they're getting the same working circumstances as everybody else, then just like us, they'll be shitty at cutting those circumstances because they'd be cutting themselves, at worsening those conditions because they'd be worsening their own conditions. So we put them in an air-conditioned office and we, you know, give them a desk and we say, okay, fuck us. Why? Because it's the only way we can compete and keep our jobs. Mm-hmm. This is Yugoslavia, right? Mm-hmm. This is market socialism, mm-hmm. I believe. This is the essence, the underneath part of why, in addition to, you know, piling up pollution and all the rest of it.
It's, Michael, couple minutes here, and we don't have to stop right at the top of the hour. Unless
I'm fine, whatever you want.
I just wanted to ask it in conclusion, perhaps, about the Mark Evans when he was writing a review of the upcoming book. He mentioned that your position on artistic questions and intellectual property might be controversial, and I'm curious what I didn't come across the part anything I disagreed with, but I was wondering what he's talking about.
This is a big and an interesting. Or at least I find it an interesting thing. My sister's an artist, and my sister reacted negatively to participatory economics early on. And then, you know, I've had other people react negatively too, who are artists, who view themselves as creative producers, I suppose you could think of, musicians, to a degree, writers. To a degree, you know, I don't know what else, but artists, painters. And the notion is, wait a minute, this sounds good for everybody else, but I don't want consumer councils and worker, I want to be in control of my creative potentials and capacities, just me, right? And so the reaction is actually, I think, a sort of a coordinator class reaction, although they don't know it, right? Because, of course, there's nothing about this that's saying that you're not in control of your own creative potentials. It's exactly giving you that control of your own creative potentials. But you have to produce stuff that's socially desired to get income for your production. And they don't like that because they say, well, you know, what if nobody likes my art? That doesn't matter. I should still get paid for it. And I say back, in this society, do you still get paid for it? If you do, it's because you convinced money bags mm-hmm. to hire you, right? So who do you have to produce? Who do you have to convince in a participatory economy? Well, you have to convince your fellow artists in the Workers' Council that what you're doing is a worthy contribution to the social production of the community of artists. That should be a lot more appealing to you than trying to, you know, convince money bags. And the discussion goes on. And the same thing happens about balanced job complex. Some of them will say, you want me to clean up? Now, the irony is, of course, that most artists do a lot of the rote work. You know, maybe Mick Jagger doesn't. I don't know. But certainly I undoubtedly do. People who paint. Right. People who paint, you know, do. So it's ironic, but it strikes them as wrong. They're better. And they don't see that it's no different from a lawyer or a doctor or a scientist or whatever. It's just people who have, you know, empowered circumstances and a better situation and more power defending it. And the artists have this view that it's because they're creative. And the doctor has this view that it's because he went to medical school or something. I mean, you know, it's just the same thing across the board. Wrong. The contribution is highly valuable, but people should not be remunerated for the size of their contribution. A lot of even socialists don't get that. And then I'll say to them, well, let's say that LeBron James earns $50 million this year. Is he overpaid or underpaid? And of course, they'll all say to me, are you kidding? He's overpaid. He's way overpaid. And I'll say, well, no, he's not. By your norm, he's underpaid. LeBron James contributes playing basketball that the population enjoys tremendously. And actually, the valuation of his product is way over the $50 million. But Nike gets some of it, and the TV stations get some of it, and, you know, the owner of the team gets some of it, because he doesn't have quite enough bargaining power to get it all. And so he gets less. And then they start to think, maybe there's something wrong with remunerating output. Maybe it should be how hard he works, how long he works, and the onerousness of the conditions under which he works. And we should celebrate the output. Clap for the output.
On the reverse end of that spectrum are all the artists and other people involved in cultural stuff who don't survive at it, or never have, or used to and don't now. And then the question of whose work is of value in a non-market society. There's so many ways to answer that.
I think we're going to do Revolution Z together too, where
we'll get into that question, we switch roles,
and we'll get into some of that. But for your own audience, I have a question for you that I'm going to cheat and ask now. What happened to rock and roll? Right, it's dying. I'm not up on current music, and this is probably unfair. But you know the Dylan phrase, you're either busy being born or busy dying?
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard? Right.
Yeah, I love
that. When I listen to contemporary pop music, right, and I listen to, in contrast, rock and roll, right, and I'm not talking about necessarily the very best, et cetera, et cetera. It seems to me one's busy being born and one's busy dying. There's just something missing. You know what I mean? And I'm wondering if that's fair. And I'm sure your finger is way more on top of, you know, music trends and what's happening and stuff. But that's the feeling I get. Is it fair?
I think it's very fair when you listen to pop radio. But that's more because there was an exception to the rule, which was taking place in the music industry, especially in the late 60s and early 70s.
Yeah.
And that was the exception to the rule. The rule has been a stifling industry that has made sure that very little of any value is created in New York, Nashville, or Los Angeles by this industry. But the 60s and 70s, or parts of those decades, were an exception to the rule. And it's not that there was, but there was also, of course, a tremendous social movement happening at the time, which sure. also, you know, there's a lot of reasons why there was a cultural renaissance during that period. And I would not at all argue that there wasn't a cultural renaissance. I think there very much was, but it was very much, you know, it was so big that the industry had to bend to it. And, you know, there's a wonderful book by Matt Callahan, two wonderful books by Matt Callahan on this subject about the industries in the 60s and 70s and how they had to make adjustments to this massive cultural movement that was taking right. place, especially in places like San Francisco, where the industry just had very little presence. And yet so much of the output was coming out of, you know, Northern California, you know, among other places. But right. it's modern pop, I mean, Clear Channel, now called iHeartRadio. I mean, these corporations have completely strangled, you know, creative, you know, anything that might be coming out of the major, the industry. And that's been true for over a century.
Do you watch reality shows at all? Like, do you watch, like, American Idol and stuff like that?
No, I mean, I've seen little bits of American Idol.
But I actually watch them. And it's sort of fascinating because, I mean, not only can you see... You know, you can tell who's going to get squashed, you know. In other words, you know, success in the music industry depends, I'm sure, a lot, probably overwhelmingly, on being able to withstand the pressures and accommodate them in a way that's appreciated above. And you can just tell, yeah. you know, which ones are not going to be able to do that. And it doesn't matter how talented they are. So you know that it's depressing.
Absolutely. And it's yeah. absolutely true. At that right. level, they have to be not only really talented, but yeah, also really good at dealing with all those pressures. And although I would say at the most basic level, playing for audiences of 20 or 30 people and whatever, you also have to be not dealing with those kinds of pressures, tough. But you still have to be running a business. You're running a business. And any artist who's yeah, making a living at it is running a business to survive. Yeah. So, yeah. you know, if you can't be good, if you're not good at running a business and answering the phone and keeping appointments and showing up early and that kind of thing, you're not going to make a living no matter how talented you are.
Yeah.
But you also have to be talented. You know, you got to have both of those things going. Yeah.
Yeah. Although there's different kinds of talent.
Oh, do yeah, absolutely. Favor. Some recognized, others not. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, all right.
It's been great talking to you. Looking forward to the next conversation.
I appreciate it. I hope it was, you know, constructive for your audience.
I think so.
And thanks very much for having me on.
Thanks so much, Michael. Take care.
Okay.
And this has been a discussion with Michael Albert, whose new book is coming out at the end of October on Zero Press called No Bosses, all about how we could be doing everything much differently and better and perhaps even have human civilization survive, which would be nice. All right, talk to y'all again soon. You can find this in podcast form if you look for This Week with David Rovics wherever you get your podcasts. Bye for now.